when it comes to measuring pressure, they measure it in pascals. I think a pascal is something like one newton per square meter, I think is a pascal. So air pressure is in kilopascals. I think it's something like 100,000 kilopascals is normal air pressure. That's what we think is 14 pounds per square inch. So when you deal with international sale of scientific equipment, you're going to be learning metric system pretty fast. Their screws are very different than our screws, the metric screws, where the diameters are in millimeters and the threads are measured in number of threads per millimeter, or number of threads per centimeter, as opposed to our system. I'm not quite sure what is the origin of our number six, our number eight, and our number 10 screw. I'm not quite sure how that diameter relates. Whereas with them, you look at the number on their screw and you know exactly what it is in millimeters of diameter and threads per millimeter. Their screw, in some respect, their screw measuring system is more logical. I think the United States is slowly going to have to become metricized. Even England is giving up the English system. They're becoming more and more metric. I think the craziness right now in England is, I believe, velocity is measured in kilometers per hour, but distance is still measured in miles, or the other way around. Maybe speed is measured in miles per hour, but distance is measured in kilometers. They've got a mixed system. They're slowly changing over. Their money has become metric. They don't use pounds and pence anymore in quite the same way they used to. And so our money is metric. That's good. But our distances and sizes and pressures and forces are far from metric. We measure the engine. Let me drop.
Oh, yeah.
We measure the strength of an automobile engine in horsepower. They measure it in watts or kilowatts. We measure torque in foot-pounds. They measure it in newton-meters. We measure distance in miles and feet. They measure it in meters and kilometers. They have reason to believe their system is better. And 98% of the world is using it. We're the oddballs. Anyone want to add any comments to all this? Give me your call letters right now, K2RIW.
K2OES.
Mr. OES, start up with your name, sir, and then tell us your comment.
I just want to read your paragraph that I found on the internet here. It says, when the German company he built the first European generating facility, its engineers decided to fix the frequency at 50 hertz because the number 60 didn't fit within the metric standard unit.
Okay. When you're measuring frequency in hertz, what's the difference in measuring 50 hertz versus 60 hertz? With metric system, I could measure 60 hertz very accurately, so I'm having a little trouble with that one, Fred.
And I'm just quoting you the paragraph here. It says 60 didn't fit the metric standard unit sequence 125 at that time.
Okay, that's as good a reason as any. Not good enough for me, but it was good enough for them. Anyone else want to add some comments?
WSN on the Pascal story.
Go right ahead, Paul.
Yeah, they have the one Pascal is 1 gram. One gram would weigh over the whole area of 1 square meter. So that's why it's so small. That's why you look at your pressure gauges and you'll see it's always kilopascals. You need 1,000 of these little gram things to make up any kind of pressure or anything significant. So that's what it came up with that. That's why you always kilopascals. But, yeah, I worked with a lot of people and nobody even realized that their KPA was on there. They never paid attention to it. Your mind don't see. You just see the PSI. You know, and when somebody lets you know about it, you say, hey, it's there. It's kind of like the odometers, you know, the speedometers in your car. You know, a lot of cars, you look at it, and you have both written there. You know, you have miles per hour and then kilometers. A lot of people don't pay attention to it. your mind don't even think about it, but it's, a lot of times it's right in front of you and you don't realize it.
Now, I'm looking up Pascal right now. I'm kind of amazed at what you just said. A gram per square meter. That strikes me as an extremely small amount of pressure. I'm Googling it right now. I'm just going to see what Wikipedia says. I'm kind of amazed if it's not a Newton. But we'll soon find out. Pascal is the guy's name. Okay. I'll eventually find out here the definition of the unit Pascal. Looks like I've gotten into a website that tells me about the human being, not the unit that was named after him. If you have any further comments, give me your call letters right now. Mel, why don't you go on to the next mailbag letter, and I'll continue investigating Pascal. I'm a little bit skeptical about this one.
Roger, this is K2KEY. I'd like to tell you the school situation is going crazy sometimes. You're not sure sometimes what you got. And I have gauges that measure the thread and basically identify it. So that became a very handy little system to gadget to have a little set of them. All right, what's next? Okay, here we got a question. I got a 40-meter vertical, and it works quite well. Do you think it would be ideal for me to change it? Because I want now to get on 20 meters to get a vertical, a dual band vertical, or add a coil, or is there some way you think that I can make my 40 meter vertical, which is ground mounted with quarter wave radio, work on 20 meters without too much problem? Well, good question. 20 meters being a harmonic of 40. All the amateur HF bands sort of are related that way. So what do you think? Putting two wavelengths of a vertical instead of a half wavelength system, putting the half wave system of 40 meters, combined vertical and radial, into a now become a full wave system on 20 meters, pick over.
If his feed line is low enough in loss, and if his antenna tuner has enough tuning range, and by adding random length of cable, most likely he can force it to come back into tuning range, he can definitely put a 20-meter signal into a 40-meter antenna. It's going to be a difficult match, and I'm not quite sure where the elevation angle of radiation is going to be, but he has the technology to radiate 95% of that power on 20 meters by using a 40-meter antenna. And it's not going to explode as long as you've got a big enough tuning range to his antenna tuner to protect the Viswar protect circuit of his 20-meter transmitter. That's about the worst that will happen, is it will cut back in power because his protect circuit will see a high standing wave ratio. So I think it can work. He may not be completely happy with where the elevation angle of radiation is, but that is calculatable. I would say try it, you'll like it. By the way, I found the definition of Pascal. It is a Newton per square meter, not a gram per square meter. It is a Newton per square meter, according to Wikipedia. When you look up the word Pascal, the unit Pascal, definition, one Newton per square. A Newton is an amount of pound, amount of force that is about 4/10 of a pound. So most people are not familiar with Newton. Some people are familiar with a meter, which is a little bit bigger than a yard. 39.37 inches is 1 meter. 2.5 centimeters is 1 inch. These are very handy numbers to remember when you're doing metric to English conversion. But a Pascal, a unit of pressure, is 1 Newton per square meter. Let me turn it over to Paul, and I'm wondering what made him think that it was a gram. Without a doubt, a Newton per square meter is a small amount of force, and therefore that is the main reason why we use kilopascal instead of pascal. But the amount of force is not a gram for the definition of pascal. It's the Newton of force, which is a heck of a lot more than a gram force. Over to you, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, I'm looking up Newton now. And they have... And the kilogram system, the unit of force required to accelerate one mass of 1 kilogram, 1 meter per second, per second. Well, that, if you break that down, it's going to come out to a gram per meter, Dick?
A good guess, but the answer is no. A newton is around 4/10 of a pound. A pound is something like 450 grams. So it's going to be around 100 grams. A newton, I'm going to go to my calculator, which has got a conversion chart, and I have never converted a newton to gram force. You got to be careful now. Newton is a unit of force. Gram is a unit of mass. So when you're using gram as a unit of force, you've got to tell somebody it is gram force you're talking about. Just like the word pound, most of the time when you and I measure a pound, it's a pound of butter or a pound of bread, we're talking about a unit of mass. However, we interchangeably here in the United States very freely say, yeah, a pound of force. Well, we're supposed to tell somebody we're talking about the pound force unit system, not the pound mass unit system, which in theory they differ a little bit. So I'm going to double check now as to what is a newton in grams, and I'm guessing it's going to be something well above 100 grams. Back to you, Paul.
Okay, very good. I've got another book somewhere. I know it's going to come off the internet. So, this has been in my head for too long, Dick. So let me find it. Maybe it's my old encyclopedia. I'll be back.
Okay. The good thing about my new Hewlett-Packard 50 calculator is it's got everything in there. The bad news is there's 127 menus hidden behind that screen, and to find the right button on the screen that gives you the menu of the menu of the menu to get down to the thing you're looking for, there's times where it drives me crazy. So, but getting back to your original question, Mel, I know a guy can radiate very efficiently. That is to say, of all the watts you're generating with your transmitter, 90-some-odd% of those watts can be radiated from a 40-meter antenna. It's going to be a difficult matching problem. You may not be thoroughly happy with the antenna pattern you get, but it's going to work. And the antenna pattern you're going to get is deterministic. It's something calculatable with modern-day programs or by looking at the diagrams for antenna patterns that are in the ARRL antenna book. The ARL antenna book has a bunch of diagrams telling you that if you feed the antenna on the second harmonic, the third harmonic, or whatever, this is the pattern you're going to get. So you can, with a little bit of research, you can definitely find out what pattern you're going to get. So don't be afraid. Try it. There's a good chance you're going to like it. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Okay, this is K2KEY,
K2LIW.
Okay, well, only tell you about my experience. You know I'm a low-band DXer. I got very involved in trying to copy very weak signals, especially on 80 CW. Had quite a bit of success with it. And the other day they had a contest, this past weekend, the WPX contest. So I got a chance to compare, stations, the 80 and the 40 meter band couple. Most activity because the higher frequencies above 40 meters were kind of, say, on a dead side, to say the least, even though I have to report on my 10-meter net this morning. We had some sporadic openings on 10 meters, and we did get some other stage checking. But for the most part, with 80 and 40 meters CW, that was the most activity that showed up. So I got a chance to do some switching back and forth between my vertical. I have a 65-foot vertical on ground-mounted that has 100 radials, very. I have a dipole that's about 65 feet. I have then the loop, full-wave loop, and then I have a receiving antenna, all for 80 meters. Let me let it drop. So I was able to switch back and forth, going from one to the other, trying to get some really idea of what's going on, you know, with different stations, different signals, and how can you be amazed at this state. No one size fits all for this situation. It was a toss up sometimes, which antenna was doing it, was doing the right job. So, as far as going on for 40 meters, let's get back to 40 meters. I take the 8-meter vertical, and I have at the bottom, I have a little network. I have a tuning network on the bottom of the vertical for putting it on 40. I also have that tuning network for two reasons. Number one, it gives me a ground return, a direct ground return, right there, an inductance and capacitance. I tune out whatever reactance right there. I have two taps, one for 40, one for 80, one for 40. But it also gives me the inductance because one end of the inductor is actually going directly to the ground. So it gives me a ground return for the vertical, which I think, maybe I'm wrong, but I think that makes it a little quieter for atmospheric conditions. What do you think about that? I meant to bring that up a number of times. In other words, returning, having a ground potential at the bottom of the vertical maybe quiets down some of the noise that Mother Nature generates over.
I've heard a lot of people say that a properly installed vertical antenna quite often has less man-made noise than horizontal. Sort of stands to reason that the majority of man-made noise is going to be eventually connected directly or indirectly to the power wiring, and the power wiring of your community, the distribution wiring and the transmission wiring, is all horizontally polarized. So it would stand to reason that man-made noise is going to be a lot more of it horizontally polarized than vertically polarized. Whether or not local ground affects the amount of noise you get, that to me is a little bit controversial. But there are people who think, depending on how you ground the antenna, you make a significant difference in the amount of noise that you see. But where you've run vertical antennas and horizontal antennas, I'm going to guess some of the time the vertical antennas seem to be quieter. I wonder if that's what you've seen, Mel. Go ahead.
Well, I'm going to tell you, the quiet antenna overall, besides my receiving loop, the shack, but that has, you know, the way I have it set up, I can phase out noise by using the one sensing loop, the loop inside of the loop. There's two loops independently that they can move and pivot and all that stuff. And so I just, you know, use one. I use it, that nulling effect, the phase canceling, and then through Q multiplication, I am able to pick out many times very weak signals. But the problem is a lot of manipulation drives you crazy because you've got to resonate them. You've got to, they're very sensitive. You cannot move off frequency any amount without re-resonating that loop. Because remember, it's 12 feet square on 80 meters. So we think we figured out what part of the wavelength that is. Now, however, if you get it, and once you get everything adjusted, that station's going to be on there for a while. That's the quiet. The next I will say is the outside loop, the one I use for transmitting. That's 272 feet of wire fed with 600 ohm open wire feeders and approximately 45 feet up. That, I would say, as far as the outside antennas are, by far the quietest of all the antennas for some reason. That the loop guy wire type setup seems to, some reason, be quieter than a dipole and a vertical. I would say the vertical is quieter than a dipole, and the loop, the upside loop, is the quietest of the three of them. Over.
Yeah, some of the quietness of the loop, in my opinion, is because you're able to adjust it in azimuth, elevation, and polarization. Therefore, you can maximize the signal-to-noise ratio of the guy you're listening to, because he's getting there by way of the ionosphere, which is twisting it, the Faraday rotation or whatever. You can maximize his signal. Therefore, your automatic gain control of your receiver sees the strongest signal, cuts back the gain the most. Therefore, you hear the least amount of noise in the background. That's what I think is some of what's going on here, Mel. So your loop itself, I mean, any antenna that's picking up a certain number of watts per square meter of power flux density, or it's picking up a certain number of volts per meter of E field. That's what an antenna does. If the antenna is picking up the volts per meter or the watts per square meter, how much noise it picks up and how much signal it picks up, if everything was the same, should be identical from antenna A to antenna B, if they've got the same gain characteristic or the same effective area. But where you're able to pick up with your loop the exact characteristics of the signal that's coming into you, because the antenna is small, it's in your hand, and you've got this fancy mount where you can skew it in azimuth, elevation, and polarization. Therefore, you get the strongest possible signal. Your AGC gives you the most amount of AGC gain cutback function. Therefore, you hear the least amount of noise in the background, and the signal sounds quieter to you. It isn't because the antenna is rejecting noise. The antenna is doing the best job of accepting the signal, and therefore your AGC is rejecting the noise. That's what I think is going on. I'm going to pass it back to you for comment on that, Mel. But before I do, if Paul is listening, 1 newton is 101.97 grams. So a little bit less than 102 grams is a newton. A newton is very close to a quarter of a pound force, or another way of looking at it is 4.44 newtons is a pound. So a newton is smaller than a pound in force, but a newton is 102 grams. So, and a pascal, according to Wikipedia, pascal as a unit is a newton of force per square meter of area. I can repeat all that if need be, Paul. WS2N, we're slowly learning the metric here, all of us, the metric system. I'm learning some of this jazz as we speak. KQRIW, you got it, Paul.
Okay, Dick, yeah, I'm showing that, well, then I go to the definition of newton. I've got one metric unit of force equaling 10 to the fifth power of dyne. Now then, they say the force needed to impart to 1 kilogram an acceleration of 1 square meter, 1 meter squared. So if you take 1 kilogram, which is 1,000 kilograms, over that 1 square meter, well, you know, that's a big difference. That's a big difference. You know, that's a, they're saying 1,000 grams to 1 square meter, Dick. Wow. Okay, we're going to go with that.
Okay, you're mixing two concepts together here. Be careful on this one, Paul. You've heard of the formula F equals MA, force equals mass times acceleration. That's the basic Newtonian physics law that is used for defining acceleration, velocity, forces, and whatever. A newton is defined as a kilogram of mass accelerated at the rate of 1 meter per second squared, 1 meter per second of acceleration. That's what a newton of force is, and a newton of force turns out to be a little bit less than 102 grams. It turns out to be a little bit less than a quarter of a pound of force, or conversely, 4.4 newtons equals 1 pound. But now, that's an amount of force called a newton. And if you apply that amount of force to 1 square meter, that amount of pressure is called a pascal. Because the newton has a kilogram in its definition, doesn't mean that you're applying a kilogram of something to the square meter when you define a pascal. Be careful you don't mix those together. So you use the kilogram as the unit of mass with F equals MA to make an acceleration of 1 meter per square to figure out what the amount of force is required, and that amount of force is called a newton. But that newton is now applied to a square meter, and it's defined as a pascal. So you could say 102 grams of force applied to a square meter is a pascal. It's not a completely legal way of mixing units, but as you can see, the real unit of pascal is related to 102 grams not to a kilogram. A kilogram is only there with the original definition of the newton, which I don't think you should apply it to a pascal. I know that's not going to all make sense the first time you hear it. Back to you, Paul, WS2N, K2RIW.
This is the reason they lost the Mars Climate Orbiter. 1999, when they had the two spacecraft, one was supposed to land, the Mars Polar Lander, and the Mars Climate Orbiter. Well, Mars Polar Lander, you know, they pretty much know that the engine shut off too early, a couple hundred feet above the ground, and it crashed. Mars Climate Orbiter, that's the one that came out with the story where they were mixing the difference between the metric system and the American system, and they were putting in different numbers. I still have a little trouble with that whole explanation that they gave, but I mean that is the official ruling on what happened to Mars Climate Orbiter. This is the problem. Very good, Dick. I came up with this somewhere, and then apparently that's supposed to be 102 grams. We'll go with that.
Yeah, try to remember. You're not going to read this in any book. A little bit less than 102 grams of force is the force of 1 newton. The original definition of a newton happens to evolve a kilogram and 1 meter per second squared of acceleration. But that's the force of a newton. A newton is the amount of force for you and I to understand is of 102 grams. I think there's roughly 29 grams per ounce. So I guess you could say it's a little bit more than 3 ounces. 3 ounces of force happens to be about a newton. Because you and I have lived our whole life in the English system, learning to convert every one of these units over to the metric system, to convert from inches and feet and miles into millimeters, centimeters, meters, kilometers, to convert pounds into newtons, to convert gallons into liters. It just goes on and on and on. We got a mountain of things to learn to become metricized. The United States made a serious effort to become metric 25 or so years ago, where all of the gas pumps were selling you gasoline in liters, and you had to figure out dollars per liter, and everybody said, no, I don't want you to tell me that. I'm not going to buy the gas from you until you tell me dollars per gallon. And so even though all of the machinery at the Shell gas station was set up in dollars per liter, we all rejected it. We rejected it with fury. I can remember the anger that people had in those days, and they had to give it up. We forced it down people's throat too fast. I mean, when you've lived your whole life with one system of units, the other system of units has got to be introduced slowly. You can't learn to swim by being thrown into the rapids. That's what we were trying to do with people. You might have some comments. I wonder if you remember that episode about 25 years ago. I'm going to turn it over to Mel for him to describe it to us. But first, Paul, do you remember about 25 years ago when they tried to sell us gasoline in dollars per liter? WS2N, K2RIW.
And WE2CDO is fighting it.
No, I don't recall that one. I remember the confusion driving around Canada with that whole leader business. But I remember them trying to force that down our throats here. Back here.
Imperial gallons.
Oh, yeah, you got gallons and imperial gallons. A liter is a little bit less than a quart, as I remember. Hey, Andy. Andy, WHUCDL. How metricated is all of our repeater system of the Limark repeater group? And how metricated are you? You got it, Andy.
How you doing, guys? I just got I got up here, and I'm really tired. Had a big day today. Big weekend, by the way. I'll tell you all about that. I'm still not on the metric system. Even though my speedometer, my 2002 Explorer, does say kilometers per hour or whatever it says. the odometer and the speed and everything else. But, I guess I come from the old school. Have trouble converting. Hey, Dick, I just wanted to mention, if you don't mind, just a few things. Just to bring you up to date on a couple of things, is that okay?
It's your repeater. I'd better let you do it. Go ahead, Andy.
Okay, very good. First of all, I went to the air show yesterday at Jones Beach. I wonder if anybody spoke about that. And I saw the Blue Angels. And, of course, it's amazing to watch these planes in action and how they do their maneuvers and so on. I would gather in this day and age, given the, I forget, what planes are the Blue Angels? They're the F-18 or the F-22, I believe. The F-22 are the Blue Angels. I believe, and it's amazing when they fly over in the diamond shape, how they go literally from wingtip to wingtip in formation there. It's got to be computer controlled. Maybe you can elaborate on how the planes talk to the planes. Besides piloting the planes, there's got to be computer interface between it because it's so precise. It's amazing. It's amazing to see them. All the other acrobatic stunts that were going on. Today as well. But today I had another event to go to. So I wanted to mention that. Maybe you could elaborate on it. And also, hey Dick, did you happen to see the big issue of CQ magazine? If you didn't, Joe Taylor, K1JT, and I know you know about this because you responded to an article that he wrote regarding your March issue of your article in the CQ regarding the Doppler effect that's caused by moving aircraft, and then you responded with a piece that they wrote down on his spectrogram that he showed a picture of and how you analyzed it. If you want to elaborate on that, Dick, maybe you can. I just thought I'd bring that up. Back to you, Dick, on both subjects.
VH Wally, what would a comment on the air show? I'm looking at a photograph right now that a buddy of mine with a very high-resolution camera took at the air show, and it shows the six airplanes of the Blue Angels, very dark-colored blue airplanes with a number on the tail, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Is that what you saw? A single tail jet airplane, very dark blue coloring, red wing tips, red tip on the rudder, and a number on each one of the tails. Is that what you saw at that air show yesterday, Andy? Go ahead.
Yeah, that's what I saw, but at the speeds that they go, it's hard to see the numbers, of course. I had a pair of binoculars, but it's almost impossible to keep up with their speed. So, yes, to answer that question.
VHYY. Joe recognized, and, yep, I recognized, as I said, a buddy of mine just mailed me that picture. Tell us about that air show, Joe. WHYY, K2RIW, and the Tech Net.
Hi there, Andy and Dick. I went to the air show on Saturday. They use F-18 Hornets. I don't think they use a Super Hornet, which is a larger frame, it's an extended version of Hornet. They use the Hornet because it's of its high maneuverability. You talk about communications. I haven't quite figured out from what I was listening to, but they used a below 2 meter frequency, around 139 meg FM, narrowband FM. That was one channel I found. But all the communication when the stuff is in the air doing the flying was above 225 megahertz, between 225 and 380.
Joe, were you able to listen to any of that chatter during the actual event itself? Did you have the right kind of equipment with you? How about you, Joe?
Yeah, of course, Dick. Why else would I go there? Yes, I did some interneting before I went there. The night before, I found a bunch of frequencies, and I put a bunch of frequencies in my radio and in a portable handheld scanner, and I was able to listen to frequencies. They seem to use about five or six different frequencies, almost like the ground was talking on some frequencies, and you hear planes talking on others. I haven't figured out the whole scenario exactly how they do it, but there were several frequencies being used in AM modulation above 225. The frequency started at approximately 238 megahertz up to about 281. maybe a little higher. There was a bunch of different channels I found in that region of the spectrum.
During the actual event, what kind of chatter goes on between the pilots themselves as they're forming those formations and doing those maneuvers? What kind of chatter did you hear, if any? Back to you, Joe.
I heard mostly between the planes, or I guess the plane to ground, was probably where the guy was just saying like one or two or three words, but extending the words out, because it sounded like these guys were going through the effect of pulling G's. They were talking very, very slowly as it was doing something. You know, they were extending out the syllables of different words as they seemed to be doing different maneuvers. That's what I seemed to notice quite a bit.
Okay, and I am curious, what kind of words did you hear them saying very slowly, Joe?
In the higher aerobatic maneuvers that, they'd say like more nose up, and they would extend those three words maybe to a point of maybe 15 seconds long. Like they were trying to not strain in talking, something like that. I mean, I don't remember every single thing they said. And other times you hear more normalized speech where they're going anywhere between, say, 430 knots, somewhere around those speeds, which is about what they seem to be traveling. And a knot is 1.15 miles per hour, in case you want to check out on your calculator.
So are you telling me they were reading out knot speeds? Is that how you had figured out how fast they were moving, Joe? Go ahead.
Yes, they were occasionally at different times and at different maneuvers, they were definitely calling out the speed of what they were traveling. Apparently, speed and timing is very critical to what they're doing. Yes, I did definitely hear that, heard that several times.
And I think this event took place at Jones Beach. Is that true? And my guess is it went on for a couple of hours, and I bet you there were a lot of people there, and I bet you driving away you got into a bit of a traffic jam. Is any of that true, Joseph?
All is correct. They took off at a Republic Airport, landed back at Republic Airport. That's where I think all the other planes came from, and they ran the show. I think pretty much like it did in the past, they had a lot of the earlier World War II aircraft doing flying formations and things like that in the beginning of the show. And the last, like, say, 90 minutes or so of the show was the FA-18 Hornets, Blue Angels. Yes, the traffic wasn't so bad for me because I was going east, but I would imagine people who are going west back to the city, they probably have maybe a little rougher go of it.
Yeah, for those people who really like seeing Navy aircraft, you definitely want to catch any one of the series on public broadcasting system called Carrier. It's a sequence of four or five shows of 2 hours each, and they show you what life on a carrier is really like. And my goodness, it's something very different than you would expect. A carrier is something like a 1,000-foot long ship. It contains more than 5,000 human beings. It's a real city. It's got its own radio station, its own barbershop, a zillion different cafeterias, and interesting stories when it comes to the pilots trying to land in a rolling sea at nighttime to land back on that carrier. It gets pretty exciting. Some people describe a aircraft carrier landing as a controlled crash. To a degree, it is. It can be a pretty rough process and quite a bit of risk involved. So, interesting process if you like high speed hardware. Powerful hardware. And on that carrier deck, everybody's got to know their job as to exactly where they should be looking and exactly where they should be moving at every instant of time. You break that sequence, there's a chance you're going to get yourself in an awful lot of trouble. I know there's a couple of reasons I was going to pass it back to you, Mel, and sounds like you're slowly becoming metricated. I'm slowly becoming metricated. So is Paul. So is Joe. People who work in science and people who have to deal with hardware that eventually has international trade characteristics, you know, can't avoid the metric system. 98% of the world is metric. we live in our own little cocoon here in the United States, and we think the whole world is on the English system. You start communicating with amateurs in any other country, and if you don't use the metric language, they start laughing at you pretty fast. That's my experience, particularly when I talk to XQ2FOD, Manfred Mundhenweg, at the La Salina, Chile, South America. KE2, there we go. I keep confusing the call letters. K2KEY. K2RE.
Demetrio, one final comment on your last transmission about carriers.
Hey, go ahead, Joe. Tell us about carriers.
Yeah, I've watched quite a bit of different videos on there are various different channels of landing aircraft on carriers. I've seen the effect of what happens when those wires break. You have to hit the trip wire, and a wire actually breaks. It causes a tremendous amount of problems very, very quickly, and if you're not paying attention, I think it basically just about cut you in half and knock you off your feet and injure you extremely severely. But here's an interesting piece of information I happened to catch from one air show I had out in West Hampton Beach many, many years ago. They had a couple of F-14, which is known as a Tomcat. I ended up talking to the pilot, and I happened to just ask him. I said, how many, and they use a tail hook like all the other aircraft away than an aircraft carrier. I just happened to ask him just off the top of my head. I said, how many traps, and a trap is a link call a landing, how many traps you get out of your tail hook? And the guy told me only about 20. After about 20, the thing is basically stretched out to the point where it's not useful anymore. So there's a little piece of information for you, Dick. And an F-14 weighs approximately 30 tons.
Yep. I'm working right now with an F-14 pilot, a former F-14 pilot. And he can describe quite a few hair-raising stories of what it's like. I think it's about a 70,000-pound airplane fully loaded. Fully loaded, you cannot come back to the runway without dumping some of that mass. You'll collapse the gear. When it hits the, I think there's four arrest wires, and if you miss all four, it's called a bulk. And when that hook goes bouncing across the deck at nighttime, making all those sparks, that's an exciting thing to watch. When it catches one of those wires, the total amount of force on that wire is something like 100,000 pounds. Maybe it's 150,000 pounds. Oh, wait a minute now. It's a 30-ton airplane, probably being decelerated at 5 Gs, 4 Gs, 5 Gs. So we're talking about more than 120 tons. So we're talking about a good fraction of 1 million pounds of force is on that tail hook. And if that wire breaks, the stored energy in that wire, because it was stretched before it breaks, will whip that wire across the deck at almost the speed of sound, and it definitely has the ability, in the worst case scenario, to slice through a human being. You don't want to be in the vicinity of where that wire is going to go if it breaks. No human being is supposed to be standing there if he's in the right place at the right time. Another exciting thing about a carrier landing is that at the instant your wheels touch the carrier, whether you catch a hook or not doesn't matter. The instant your wheels touch the carrier, the pilot must, by training, put full throttle. He's near full throttle already because he's already doing what's called flow flying with all of his flaps and flaps out and everything else, landing gear. He's got a lot of drag on that airplane. So he's already got pretty close to full thrust. But at the instant he hits the carrier deck, he puts the engine full thrust forward to spool up the engine just in case he does bolt. If he misses the last wire, that engine's got to be giving him full thrust when he comes off the end of that carrier so that he's able to fly again and come around. If he doesn't do that and he's going to hit the water, life gets very complicated. The chance of surviving if you're in that cockpit when it hits the water are not good, and you're about to waste a $70 million airplane, because if it hits the water, it's a useless piece of junk. So, query. Yeah, go ahead with query.
WB2EAB also.
It's N2APG with query. Go ahead, Dave. Okay, while we're on the topic of arresting cables, I had a question. I understand they installed arresting cables on one of the runways at Republic today, and I assume it's specifically for
the Blue Angels, because I think they're the only planes that have the hooks. Now, I've seen them take off and land when they're over there. I've never seen them need to use arresting cables, so I'm assuming they put the arresting cables on one of the runways for like a safety or in case there's an emergency. But I don't know for sure. I'm just wondering if anyone knew, why would they install arresting cables over at Republic for the Angels?
WB2EAB, but not to answer that.
Okay, let's go over to Ed first, and then we'll try to work out those answers. Go ahead, Ed.
I'm not sure what brought this up, but after listening for 5 minutes, I can't take it anymore. They're arresting cables, and if you don't trap, you bolter, and you come in dirty up, 135 knots, 4-degree glide slope. You do not flare. You hit the deck at 135 knots, 4-degree glide slope. When the pilot feels the bone-jarring crash, he brings the throttle balls to the wall, hoping that if he bolters, he's got enough spooled up RPMs that the thing will go up, not down. That's just the beginning.
Sounds like you've studied the subject. Give us more of the gory details, Ed.
As a rule on an aircraft carrier, if you're in the wrong place at the wrong time, you die. Yes, the planes do have arresting cable failures, and people often do die, particularly if they do stupid things. I know of the story where the plane ended up dangling off the end of the deck by the snagged arresting cable around the tail hook, and they were bringing the crane over to pull the plane in when the pilots panicked, punched out, hit the ejection seats, and got splattered against the side of the carrier and killed. There are many ways on an aircraft carrier that it can kill you. Taking off is equal and opposite with the steam catapult flinging you off the front. By the way, Dick, Wednesday evening I was tooling around St. Augustine Airport's taxiways in the co-pilot seat of an E-2D. Dick?
Boy, that's got to be exciting. San Augustine, Florida, I believe, is the Navy repair depot for either EA-6Ds or E-2Cs, E-2Ds. Navy aircraft, I believe quite a few of the repairs take place in St. Augustine, Florida. Sounds to me like you were down there for Northrop Grumman, and I bet you had an exciting time. Were you checking out some of the electronics on the E-2D? Is that why you were in that aircraft, in that location, at that time? Back to you, Ed.
We were trying to confirm whether or not the airframe, E-2D, by the way, is brand new. There's only two prototypes in St. Augustine. We were trying to confirm that the airframe did not affect the antenna patterns of the IFF antenna, which is associated with the radar antenna. To do that, we took it out to the end of a taxiway, basically in the middle of nowhere. We took a van. We didn't use an HP-8640, but very similar to the thing we were discussing about a month ago, with a little putt-putt gasoline generator, a IFF frequency signal generator, and a horn antenna to be a source tower. And with the rotodome rotating, we were able to see antenna patterns on the screens on the plane, and then they rotated the plane in 20-degree steps so we could get samples to see the effects of the airframe on the patterns. Since we weren't flying, we had one pilot, and he asked me as a favor to take the co-pilot seat while we were taxiing out and back.
I'll bet you were in seventh heaven. I could just see the smile on your face now, sitting in the co-pilot seat on that aircraft doing that operation. The one thing I've got to ask, though, is that your source of signal, the 8640 signal generator or equivalent, with the signal, with the putt-putt generator, as you put it, was emitting a signal at a particular elevation angle off of the deck. It sure would be nice if you had the ability to change that elevation angle, because when it comes to an antenna pattern from that radome, you're going to get one antenna pattern on the horizon, a slightly different antenna pattern a couple of degrees above the horizon and below the horizon. I know that would be an elaborate test, I'm sure you guys didn't go that far, but I bet you at least considered the possibility. Back to you, Ed.
Considered and rejected with much laughter.
Okay. In other words, if you were able to use a transmitting tower that was at essentially the same altitude as what the radome is going to see when the aircraft is flying at its normal angle of attack, the rotor dome, if you could get the antenna signal squirted in at its foresight, that's good enough. My guess is as you move the aircraft around, only when the vertical stabilizer was in the way did you see any significant change in pattern. Is that approximately true?
Take a look at a picture of NED2. There are four stubby vertical stabilizers for that very reason. The only real effect that we saw, which was not a major problem, but it was noticeable, but remember, it's a twin turboprop. We did notice propeller modulation, but it was not a serious impact.
Very nice. During the test, you guys are running the propellers at probably an idling speed. I think you had the ability, if you wanted to feather the props and run them at a higher velocity, but that really isn't required. Now, that just is the modulation rate. That doesn't really change the pattern. So the propellers did make a little bit of an effect. I guess you're saying the props are big enough that they essentially get into the antenna pattern very slightly. Is that true?
Exactly. And let me tell you, from the co-pilot seat, that is one big prop. And it is a mean, nasty-looking thing that would kill you as soon as looking at you.
That's why they paint the tips a very bright color. I have talked to friends of mine that lived on a carrier for a while. They described the scene of what it's like when a human being walks into the prop of an E2C. It's not pretty, and the man didn't survive. One other man got sucked into an engine of a EA-6 and hung on to the cowling and didn't go all the way into the engine. And he held on to the flashlight that was in his hand, didn't let go, didn't create fob damage to the engine, and got an award for doing that. Wow. Carrier life can be rough. You were in that co-pilot seat. By the way, in that co-pilot seat, you were sitting on top of an ejection seat. I am guaranteeing that you had standboard training ahead of time. Standard board training means you learn where all the pyrotechnics are, and you are taught very distinctly what not to touch. Because depending on how you were strapped into that seat, if somebody pulled the chicken wing by mistake, your life would get very complicated very fast. Is that true, Ed? Go ahead.
Sorry, Dick. No ejection seats. There is one door and three rooftop escape hatches. One over the pilot seat, one over the co-pilot seat, and one over the rearmost of the three radar operator seats. When there is a problem, you remove the escape hatch, the ones in front slide back, the one in the back drops down. Then you stand on the seat, then you put your hands on the roof of the plane, then you step up on the top of the seat, and then you pull yourself up out the roof, which when you ditched works pretty well. When you're on a runway, you're now on the top of the plane, far enough above the runway that you're going to end up in the hospital no matter what you do.
Yeah, and if you try to drop down the side of that fuselage, my guess is that prop that's nearest you of the four props is extremely close. How in the world, if that prop is turning and you're on the top of that fuselage, getting off there ain't easy. Is that true?
Quite true, quite true. It isn't easy even when they're not running.
What's the approximate amount of clearance between that prop and the nearest section of the fuselage?
Between the prop and the door, definitely not enough. The front escape hatches, I'd say it's about 7 or 8 feet. People have been known when they have a problem to go down over the nose just to stay away from the props. The one in the back is pretty far behind the props.
And there is no ladder or anything like that on the side of the fuselage you can climb down. So getting off the top of the fuselage in an emergency circumstance, like you said, you're probably, what, 15 feet off the deck? That's a difficult drop.
I estimated 18. We're in the ballpark, but I will tell you, the way my back has been lately, I said, if that engine, if the left engine, the one right by the door, catches fire, it don't matter what I do. I'm dead.
I see you've got a good gallo sense of humor, Red. You were in that co-pilot seat for what length of time, and I bet you were smiling the whole time and looking at the instrument panel, among other things.
About 10 minutes out, 10 minutes back, and I spent 2 hours in the radar operator's seat actually doing the measurements. Let me put it this way, Dick. You know the old saying, you can tell the men from the boys by the price of their toys? Well, I hit the jackpot on that one. I gotta go right now. I will call back in on a rubber ducky for my evening constitutional, okay?
Roger, Dodger. One last question. Is that aircraft worth roughly 100 megabucks?
If it ever goes into production, I can get you one for 180 million. The development contract is 2 planes for 2 billion. So I don't know anybody who's gone tooling around in a $1 billion vehicle other than me.
Okay, but they're cheaper by the dozen. They get cheaper in quantity. Okay. And when you come back later on, I'd love to know how many are proposed to be built. I'm hoping a good number of really pretty looking airplanes. Hey, Mel, we better send it back to you. We got way off subject, but we got into something that was a lot of fun. You know, a little bit of entertainment sneaks into the tech net from time to time. And so I just love airplane stories. K2KEY, K2RIW.
2HWW with a comment.
Okay, stand by, Howie. Mel, go ahead, Howie.
I was listening to your previous comments about the antennas and why that antenna is more quieter. When you have a coil and he's shut-jetting it, where one side of the coil is at ground potential, he's getting rid of all the static electricity. That's why when you know, that's the best way to do it, a vertical with some kind of a network that keeps you hot, you know, at ground potential.
Now, you've got a point that I didn't consider, electrostatic discharge in the near vicinity of the antenna can certainly make an awful lot of nasty noise. The majority of the noise that antennas pick up, though, under normal circumstances, when you don't have a lightning storm coming nearby, really is precipitation static over the horizon, man-made noise, things like this. If an antenna is going to receive a signal, and if on the exact same frequency noise exists, whether it be man-made or made by Mother Nature, in general, in my opinion, the antenna cannot select one kind of signal versus the other kind of signal. What you and I call noise to that antenna is a signal. It doesn't have the intelligence to know the difference. So the quieter conditions that Mel experiences with his loop, I think it's because he's able to tune it to the best signal-to-noise ratio, therefore he's getting the most amount of AGC action of his receiver. That's a guess on my part. Let's see what Mel thinks. K2KEY, K2RIW.
We're talking about different antennas. This is KQKEY. Let me make some comments. The quietest one, as I said, is the receiving loop in the shack. But remember, that is two antennas, two loops, that I am resonating on that frequency. I am then going through, I can't really say per se, you know, what's going on, because they have to work in conjunction with this gadget that I built. QRN squasher and the Q multiplier. So that's the final product, is what I'm saying is the quietest of the whole system. But remember, I'm going through all this other, you know, manipulation, and this is most likely accounts for a good part of that situation. Dick, is the configuration of using that QRS squasher and Q multiplier. As far as outside goes, I always thought, I don't know, anytime I've had a sort of a vertical outside I always said, gee, that thing poking up in the air, I know its chance of getting hit by lightning is small, but I have had the power hit three times.